This is audible.
Halfway Bitten. Halfway Witchy, Book 2. Written by Terry Maggard. Narrated by Aaron Spencer. Chapter 1. Mail Call. The moon hung full, meaning I would sleep on the couch to listen for the squeak of my mail slot, announcing the plaintive request for a secret spell. That was where people who I rarely knew would push a handmade envelope through the slim space to fall into my home. The letter would slide across the floor with a swishing rasp before coming to a stop. I would then open each letter in the moonlight of my kitchen, where I got down to the business of being a good witch. In a sense, I grant wishes. I have growing power. I'm a work in progress, I guess. And I feel it in my bones that every little bit of effort must be made to keep the most subtle kinds of evil at bay. Things like loneliness, fear, a loss of caring. These are the things that all of my spell requests are built around. The words change, but the pleas are always the same. I think that because of this ability to use my magic, I understand that there must be goodness in the world in order to foster even greater kindness. I'm okay with that. It's my calling. My gran taught me that goodwill should be freely given. The ability to be kind without strings is the mark of pure magic. Its sole purpose can only be fulfilled when there is no expectation of reward. In a sense, the envelopes that fall to the wood floor of my foyer are the closest thing to a physical prayer that I will ever see. I treat each request with the care it deserves, and I am utterly committed to lessening the suffering of the people around me. Gran always told me that someday I'd think of myself as a priestess who cared for the world around me. And I think I'm starting to understand. The moon slides across my kitchen in a soft pane of light for 3 nights out of each month, unless it's cloudy, or snowing, or raining. It's during this transit of light that I wait in a state somewhere between dreams and reality. If I doze too soundly, Gus will wake me when an envelope arrives. But for the most part, there's a part of my mind that anticipates each quiet plea. To fill the hours between now and then, I went to the kitchen to graze. It's a scientific fact that if you eat while standing over the sink, it is neither a meal nor does it count against your alleged workout plan. Fortunately for me, the diner keeps me in shape. But that doesn't stop me from feeling a twinge of guilt when I eat something that has no nutritional value whatsoever. Like right now. I selected a spoon that is just small enough to fit in my mouth, opened the fridge, and pulled out a tub of homemade peach ice cream. "Hello, beautiful," I murmured. "We're about to get uncomfortably close for the next half hour." I spooned the first frigid bite of heaven into my mouth, and let my eyes close with the kind of pleasure that only ice cream or a lingering kiss can bring. The spoon rested on my tongue, cold and brittle, and I was moving to dredge another bite when the mail flap opened and an envelope slid onto the floor. Gus eyed the ice cream with a feral speculation. He wasn't above pilfering licks if I left the tub unattended, so the ice cream went with me to the foyer. I bent to pick it up, and my hand stopped in midair. The paper was marred by 3 dark smears, but I knew it wasn't ash or ink. It was blood. Moonlight had a curious effect on many things. It can spawn romance or poems. It can light the water at night, and the snow, too, spangling the frozen crystals with the second-hand sun from the other side of the world. In the fall, it can turn an innocent night into something sinister, looming over the harvest like a fat reminder that the veil between worlds is thin indeed. But for blood, it takes that which is crimson and makes it black, and I know this because it's something I've seen before. I reached for my power and let my senses drift across the innocuous paper, and I was sorry that I did. Fear, like blood, can stain things, and this message was fairly soaked with a kind of terror that can kill. Gus padded over and uttered a low growl from the depths of his throat. He felt the wrongness of the aura permeating the note. I guess I have to open it. Gus hunkered down next to me, an expectant look on his broad feline face. I stood and turned on the hallway light, then plucked the envelope from the floor and opened it in one smooth motion. It was a torn piece of paper, yellowed from sun or weather. The smell hit me first, a melange of age and the coppery bite of blood that was still too fresh to be oxidized. The words were clearly written with a fingertip, and in a hand that shook so badly, I wondered if the author had survived to the end of the message. I read, turned my eyes for a moment to steady myself, and then read the note once again. When they find her, you will know. Please do not forget the rest of us. My mind screamed at the opaque meaning, knowing that somewhere in the depths of those few words was a message that could save lives. I knew intuitively that what I held in my hand had been written at great cost, and curling fingers of dread hooked around my spine and began to squeeze, just to let me know that I was powerless in that moment. I sat down on the floor of my foyer and felt the first hot tears of rage spill down my cheeks, hating that all I could do was wait. If you know me at all, you know there are certain things I'm not very good at. Reaching things on the third shelf? Not my thing. Eating butter beans? No way. But the thing that actually galls me is to wait. Yet, that's exactly what I did, resting on the couch with Gus until my gray eyes were dark hollows in my face. The sun rose as my stomach roiled with frustration and guilt, but as the light became impossible to ignore, I rose and went to make coffee. I stood, sipping the first cup, my eyes gritty and red. I could feel the low simmer of anger percolating within me, even as I stepped into the shower. This was going to be a bad day. I considered and discarded dozens of possible meanings for the note before walking to work with my head down and eyes locked firmly on the sidewalk. It was too early to bother Gran, but I resolved to call her when I could steal a moment away from the grill at the diner. I knew we'd be slammed, but there was something about the note that froze the marrow in my bones. I didn't know what was coming, but I could tell it was going to be bad. Chapter 2. Clowning Around. If I ride my bike to work, it takes 3 minutes. Walking takes 10. I chose to walk. The sun broke over the lake in a fury of gem-like flames. Halfway is a lake made in heaven, and the town curls around it like a jealous lover. At 5 in the morning, it's sleepy and quiet, with only the occasional rowdy goose or loon breaking the silence. The only humans moving around, other than me and a few bakers, are fishermen. They have the excellent sense to limit their noise and speech under the auspices of not scaring their prey. I applaud that kind of dedication to avoiding human contact before you're fully caffeinated. I unlocked the diner side door and slipped into the quiet cool. This was the magic hour, before any other employees were around, and the entire space was mine. 3 days a week, Lewis would be waiting to greet me. He started baking at 2 in the morning, but not today. There was no aroma of flour or sweets and coffee, just the welcoming stillness and a lingering hint of something fried and delicious. Glenna and Pat would arrive later. Between the two of them, they could organize the invasion of a modest country. They're both seasoned veterans, who know that coffee comes first, chit-chat is second, and smiles are constant. It's no surprise that getting a job here is rare, but keeping it is common. I set coffee to brew, wrapped a snow-white apron around me, and slid easily into the kitchen to begin the dance of preparing for an onslaught of bustling customers who came to eat, relax, and gaze out at the brightening surface of the lake. There are some mornings that I lose time. It's as if the muscle memory of my job takes over and bliss descends to move my hands in a familiar pattern of cooking, plating, and smiling at the general joyous chaos that erupts from the moment we open our doors. Most of the time, I love my job. Other days, I tolerate it. But this was not one of those days. This day was going to be interesting. I looked up from the grill and froze. Usually, the diner, that's the Hawthorne Diner, known to everyone in town simply as the diner, is filled with a nice mix of tourists and locals. You know the types. There are tourists wearing all manner of vacation uniforms, with the occasional sunburn mixed in for good measure. Dads wear khaki shorts, white sneakers, and an expression of relief when their kids start eating. Tourist moms wear anything that's clean, drink coffee like their lives depend on it, and always seem the smallest bit worried. Our locals wear baseball caps and an air of infinite patience, waiting for me to cook their waffles just so, without a hint of hurry. So, when I looked up and saw six clowns sitting at the counter, I took a moment. Okay, if you want to get technical, I froze. Don't get me wrong, I'm not scared of clowns. As a witch, I actually find them sort of relaxing when compared to the paranormal nasties I deal with now and again. A little face paint and red noses doesn't frighten me. But still, I just took a moment. Glynis smirked at me while she filled a row of coffee cups. Apparently even clowns enjoy a hot cup of joe. I nodded politely, looked down at my current batch of home fries that were happily sizzling away, then turned to add onions and mushrooms to an omelet that was nearly done. Despite my, stature, I can cover a lot of ground in the kitchen. I may not be tall, but I'm really busy, and that goes a long way toward making me efficient. I like that. So do our customers. Circus in town? I asked Glynna, who began to hang tickets in the window with robotic efficiency. You've probably seen someone like her before in a diner somewhere. Glynna is 50, slender, and has hair color that changes like the weather, and brown eyes that are cheery and bright. She's an inveterate coffee and sugar addict. That's what fuels her, and she avoids vegetables, meat, and milk, like one would a radioactive badger. I really need to look into her diet someday, if she'll ever stand still long enough to let me take notes about her eating habits outside work. She pointed at the array of clowns and nodded sagely. It is rolled in overnight. They've set up near the park, although I'd say it was more like a carnival. They're nice guys. They were giving away tickets at the lakeshore before they came in here to tank up on waffles. The lakeshore meant the walkway that followed a rough outline of our park, which snugs up to the water. We are exactly halfway between the beginning and the end of the Adirondack chain of lakes, hence our name, and the park is your basic giant green lawn that acted as a picnic spot, music venue, and general meeting place for friends, lovers, and the occasional dog who wanted to stretch it out and run for a bit. My town is compact, idyllic, vibrant during the summer, as all touristy places are, and frigid for the winter. It's also lousy with magic. Now, clowns aren't from the ever after, they just dress that way. Trust me, if you've ever seen an actual fairy queen, you'd think she got her wardrobe at yard sales held during the disco era. Just because you've got royal fey blood doesn't mean you have taste. I know this from experience, and I've only just stopped laughing at a printed pantsuit that a fey court member wore during a fight with a rogue werebear. If it hadn't been dangerous, I would have been too busy taking pictures for posterity. I don't care if your beauty is magically enhanced. When you combine stripes and spots, I'm going to laugh at you. I breezed through the remainder of my shift in a happy fugue, stepping out of the door at just past 2 in the afternoon. Actually, I took 2 steps, because I'm just brushing 5 feet tall and my legs are appropriately long. That is to say, they reach the ground. Barely. My eyes are gray, my hair is black, and I love my Doc Martens as much as any inanimate object on the planet, save my charm bracelet, which acts as a sort of repository for my excess magic. I've got a hidden witch mark behind my right ear. From it springs hair of every human color you can imagine, and a couple that I've only seen on really unusual cats. I use the hair for spells, on occasion, and the witch mark as a sort of early warning system for everything nasty that finds witches to be delicious or interesting. I couldn't blame the beasties, since my hair smelled of the grill, my clothes were speckled with waffle batter, and I needed a shower in that welcome sort of way you get if you love your job. I do. I'm lucky like that. So, I'm a witch, and I come from a long line of witches. My gran is sort of the de facto leader of all things magical in our area. Her decades of experience make her the go-to for all questions about the arcane. I seem to be the designated hitter in terms of pest control. I don't know whether I should be flattered or angry that I spend so many of my days off traipsing around the woods hunting down errant demons, ghouls, or undead tax accountants. It would seem the spread of evil knows no bounds, and until you've had to cast spells at a guy with blue skin, a pocket protector, and fangs, don't you dare judge me. Part of being a witch means having a familiar. Mine is a cat named Gus. He's of the Maine Coon variety, which means that his size rivals mine, and his favorite hobbies include giving me the stink eye, complaining, and trying to smother me with his tail when I take naps. In other words, he's your basic cat, just 3 times larger and more attuned to my magical needs. Gus is the only other occupant in my home. It's a small bungalow that's close to the diner, and it once belonged to my parents. They've retired and headed for the sunsets of New Mexico, leaving me my childhood home. I love everything about my house. I love the deep cool of the cellar where I perfect my magic. I love the green expanse of the lawn and the lonely apple tree that marks the eastern corner of my yard. Its branches are few but heavy with fruit each September, and I pick each apple with a reverent memory that stretches back to the first years of my life. I'm 21 years old, and I've never known another place. I belong here, and I love that fact, too. All of these things push together in my heart and leave me full and happy, a fact which naturally irritates the rare cynic I'm forced to deal with. Those people are inevitably customers who are cursed with real or imagined special dietary needs. Egg white omelets make me sad, but the people who order them make me angry. I stepped through my door and tossed the keys on a tall table that hugs the left-hand wall. Gus waited to greet me from his usual perch on the fireplace mantel. I refer to it as the Dais of Judgment, due to his unblinking stare and haughty bearing. Then again, he's a cat. They're built for that kind of subtle insult, so maybe I'm just overly sensitive since he's so confident. I admire that kind of moxie in an animal who is frightened of my sneakers, if I dare to leave them in a different position. He's a creature of habit, as am I. But you won't see me shedding like a cheap sweater when I get upset. Big difference. Gus interrupted my thoughts with a single deep, "Rawr." "Yeah, yeah, you big galoot, I'll get it." I moved unerringly to the fridge and pulled out a pitcher of actual cream. My snobby cat won't drink anything but the good stuff. After I filled a dish large enough to swim in, I started peeling off clothes and heading toward the bathroom. I took an experimental sniff as I passed my bedroom, sensing the lingering essence of Wolfric, my boyfriend. He'd left just before dawn to go on what amounted to a patrol of his lands. I should probably explain why I have a boyfriend who needs to patrol anything, so here goes. Wolfric is a 1,000-year-old half-vampire, half-Viking, who guards a section of the forest so that mortal hikers don't get turned into undead monsters by an evil spring that we sometimes call the Fountain of Youth. He also has a daughter, Amelia, with a no-good skank named Anna, who is actually a werepanther, hula hoop addict, litterer, and general malcontent. Anna's also really hot, which means that for the most part she got away with all manner of antisocial behavior, but absconding with my boyfriend's kid puts her squarely on my shit list, and I've got news for that trampy little kitten. I'm not scared of any kind of cat. I live with Gus. Chapter 3. Refugee. I let the next day get away in a sliding blur, and that isn't me. It was day two of my four-day stretch, which is nothing to me unless I let my duties as protector and witch get in the way of life's true pleasures, like making waffles. There's something wrong when I can't enjoy making waffles. This was one such day. I put on the best face possible and snuck a quick call to Gran before girding my metaphorical loins for battle. Or waffles, but you understand. I dialed her while standing in front of the expanse of glass windows that cover the diner. "Yes, dear?" She knew it was me. I felt my face flush with odd relief. "Tea after my shift?" I sounded somewhere between whiny and confused, even to myself. "Of course. I'll have a hot cup ready. Will it wait until then?" Her voice was caring, soft. "It will. Thanks, Gran. Love you." Tears dotted my eyes. I don't know what the universe saw in me, but the gift of Gran was an embarrassment of riches. "Love you, too. See you soon." She clicked off, and I realized the tension in my chest was easing just from the anticipation of her presence. I sent a little prayer on wings of thanks and stepped into the diner, where I passed my shift in a blur of tickets, plates, and banal chatter that usually warmed me from within. Today, that same routine left me wanting, and it was with a mixture of anger and relief that I stepped into Gran's house at just after 2 in the afternoon, tired and needing her presence. The phone call had only gone so far as a bandage. I needed the real thing. She's a short distance from me, and my memories of her start are the most distant images that I carry from my earliest childhood. Some of them are just hints and outlines, but taken together they form the pillars of my history, like the touch of a warm and comforting hand. I inhaled the scent of her home and felt my mood begin to shift. Her house has that effect on me. It's a soothing blend of stability and spices that fills me with thoughts of my childhood. I feel safe every time I walk through the door, and it's my harbor. "Are you here because of the body?" Gran asked, leaning against her kitchen doorframe, cup of tea in hand. She looked beautiful in a green dress and low heels. Even well into what would be old age for most women, she cut an elegant figure. Her eyes were bright blue and intelligent, and her hair was swept up in curls like a vintage pinup girl. She'd been expecting me. I stopped, lifting a boot to adjust it with one savage jerk of my thumb. "Body?" In that word, I knew I'd opened some sort of headache to the light of day. Gran jangled the keys to her pickup truck and pointed at the door. Unlike me, she can operate a vehicle without destroying it in a matter of hours, witnessed by the near-mint condition of her 30-year-old truck. "We'll speak on the way. Brendan is meeting us there." "Where's there?" I asked, even as I began to move. I knew better than to grill her if she thought we needed to be in motion. Gran winced, a sure sign that we had gone to something unpleasant. "Inlet," she replied. It was the nearest town at the head of Four Lake, and while idyllic, there was plenty of magic to be found in and around it, as well as the smaller community of Eagle Bay. We got in the truck, and Gran lost focus for a moment, letting emotions purge from her like a tea kettle at full boil. "We're going to visit an old friend, but for a very bad reason." Chapter 4. Ice Cream Ruined. Inlet looks a lot like Halfway, just smaller. There are the requisite tourist traps, local businesses, and cabins dotting the lake. Just like my town, there's a strong sense of family despite the hordes of tourists. The authentic feel keeps people coming back, and it makes them behave better, too. Gran wove through traffic to one of two ice cream parlors. This one was appropriately named the North Star and featured a faded paint and neon sign with a penguin holding an ice cream cone. There was a line of people waiting out front, and the building itself was packed with sun-browned patrons lazily enjoying all manner of frozen dairy. Occasional rebels ate sherbet, but for the most part, I saw a forest of sundaes and cones, just as it should be. We walked around back to a weathered white door, and Gran pecked twice with one knuckle in a rapid ba-bap. The door opened immediately to reveal a nervous-looking Brendan Kilmeade, his moss-green eyes shadowed with worry. He's our local librarian friend, and fully aware of the magical nature of Halfway, due to an attack by a white in which I showed him the violent side of magic. He's also cool under fire, able to keep his mouth shut and steady. If he was here and upset, it meant that I was about to get incensed by something unpleasant. I was not disappointed. We were looking into a storage area filled with stainless steel racks holding all manner of syrups, fruits, and sprinkles. Basically anything you'd ever want on a Sunday was here, except for the teenager who would actually assemble your masterpiece. I was relieved to see the room free of workers or prying eyes. "In the walk-in cooler," he said, gesturing that we should go past him to the stippled aluminum door with a sideways handle. Gran tugged it open, and the light came on instantly. She stifled a gasp, and I looked over her shoulder to see what had caused her reaction. It was a body. It had once been a living girl, but no longer. Gran looked questioningly at Brendan, who shrugged and cut his eyes at the cooler. There was room for all three of us and the corpse. Standing there like a council of judges, we all squatted to get closer to the person that rested on a cold floor, naked, curled like a child, and incredibly pale. She had been a strawberry blonde, and freckles perched on her cheeks like impudent stars. In the cooler, the air was cold and moist, and a whirring from the fan lent an industrial discord to the atmosphere. "She was found in the lake last night. It was a friend who found her. He called me and told me to bring both of you. Said you would understand." Brendan's eyes were flat with horror. Gran reached out and squeezed his hand.
"You've done right. Where was she found?"
"Just near the pass between Third and Fourth Lakes. She was found by the owner of this place, Daniel Gillen." That name, I knew. He'd been a patron of our family magic for some time, but other than the occasional foray into kitchen magic, he left the heavy lifting to us. In the stillness that hung between us all, Brendan's eyes never left the girl. The horror of her presence was inescapable.
"What do you see, Carly?" Gran asked, touching her neck remotely.
I got the message. Brendan might be aware of our nature, but he knew nothing of my witch mark. For some reason, Gran wanted that fact to stay hidden. I obliged, resisting the urge to touch the mark even as I turned my gaze to the body of the girl. I let my senses roam. Gran did the same, her eyes flickering in and out of reality in a series of minuscule ticks that were the sign of a witch casting into the ever after. Brendan cleared his throat, pointing at one of the girl's arms.
"Look at this, Carly."
The wrist he pointed to was thin, pale to the point of translucence, and embossed with assorted red marks of long confinement. Seeing that detail, I looked up and down the nude body, feeling a wash of shame at violating this poor dead girl with a simple act of looking at her. She could not give me permission, but I pressed on. I thought that if she could speak, she would tell me to find who had done this to her, and then avenge her. I lifted her arm, loose in death, and water dripped down my hand in a cold shock that held the echo of the lake.
"How old do you think she is?" I asked.
She was painfully thin, malnourished, and somehow frail. Gran lifted one of the girl's oxbow lips with a matter-of-fact flick of her thumb, revealing even white teeth.
"She's late teens, but her body is barely out of puberty. This girl has been kept somewhere."
Gran's tone was iron, and I could feel the air hum with her controlled anger.
"Kept for a long time, perhaps years. This is a young woman who has not drawn a free breath since she was late in her childhood."
I put a hesitant hand over the girl's heart, wishing it to thump under my touch. Stillness greeted me, and then the echo of her spirit charged up my fingers, only to die out like a guttering candle. I wanted to cry, but the fugitive sensation was gone as quickly as it took root in my mind. Instead, I stood numbly, and a bit confused at all of the scene.
Brendan broke the momentary quiet with an angry conclusion.
"She was groomed," Brendan said,
surprising himself. At our collective attention, he explained,
I read about things like this. Bad people keep, you know, kids, he said, pausing to gather himself.
It was a disgusting topic to discuss, but he was a scholar of sorts. With a loud exhalation, he went on.
People keep trophies. They turn humans into things. At least, that's what it feels like when I see her, laying here.
With a shake of his shoulders, he made it clear what he thought of this practice. I peered into her half-lidded eyes. They were brown, with flecks of gold. Beautiful, really. And I felt like crying when I saw the long lashes clumped into spikes by the waters of the lake. Why would someone do this? It was a maddening violation of the world, all before me in a naked sprawl. Gran nearly growled, then reached and turned the girl's head to reveal a porcelain neck shot through with fine blue veins. A series of healed punctures mottled the skin in death, just as they had while she lived.
I know why.
Gran's long fingers ticked across the divots as she traced years of violation, one bite wound at a time.
This girl was kept as a feeder.
I thought of Wolfric. Was he capable of such things? Would his human half win out, given the chance to sip from the intoxicating fountain of blood that us mortals presented? I shook myself free and looked into Gran's eyes. They shimmered with a ferocity that scared me. What are we going to do about it, Gran? I asked, knowing the answer, but needing to hear it aloud. Brendan sensed the moment as well, looking at both of us with a febrile intensity. Gran paused, then closed the girl's eyes with a rueful twist of her mouth.
We are going to track and kill every vampire who has ever put their ivory fangs into this sweet child's flesh. And then we will burn their world to the ground.
Chapter 5. All of You. The clowns were back. It was just before the lunch rush, and there were three of them sitting at a booth, picking their way through the three chopped salads I'd made for them. Under the grease paint, they were alternating between frowns and complaints, which wouldn't necessarily bother me, but my nerves were raw from the previous day. I slapped my towel down, dropped the tongs I was holding, and went out onto the floor with more than a little anger cooking in my belly. Customers averted their eyes when I passed. Good move. I was in no mood for chit-chat. What's wrong with your salads? I asked, resisting the urge to grab a fork and begin flipping the gorgeous romaine lettuce over to expose the fresh veggies and cheese. I make a damned fine salad. The tomatoes winked up like jewels, and the tuna was roasted perfectly. All three men jumped at my hostile approach and question.
You are the chef, yes?
Said the clown with blue false eyelashes. He blinked, sending the 3-inch lashes up and down in a hilarious wave, and I felt the absurdity of my anger begin to leak out of me. I drew a breath through my nose, closed my eyes, and said, I am the cook. There is no chef. Had I gone to culinary school, I would happily accept the mantle of chef, but as I did not, you must direct all questions to me. I leaned down to get closer. All three clowns drew back instinctively. The middle guy, a skinny fellow with a nose that no amount of makeup could hide, took up the narrative and ran with it. Both his companions uttered audible sighs of relief at his sacrifice. I must have looked really pissed.
Forgive me. We were merely wondering if we could have olives.
When I blinked at him stupidly, they exchanged Gallic shrugs under their fluffy costumes before the first clown added,
For the salad. Do you go with the tuna? It is quite good.
He spread his hands out in submission while I processed their eminently reasonable request.
Of course. May I bring you a dish of chopped cured olives? I asked, attempting to adopt a tone that indicated I realized the mistake had been mine.
Pride goeth before a corrected lunch, and all that. They all beamed, a terrifying conglomeration of smiles.
That would be perfect, enthused the third clown, who had apparently taken my admission of guilt as a sign that he could expect to leave the dinner alive. In the minute it took me to chop olives, plate them, and walk back to the table, I found myself composed and more than a bit embarrassed. My apology was waved away genially, and I stood talking to the men as they expertly divvied and garnished their plates. That was when I noticed they all ate carefully, but with an underlying enthusiasm that seemed almost as if they feared their plates getting up and walking away. "You know, we've just pulled the loveliest bread from the oven, salted and buttered on top. May I bring you some? As a sort of thank you for bearing with my excruciating lack of manners," I entreated, using my most winning smile. They demurred for the proper amount of seconds before allowing me to run off yet again. I know hungry people, and despite their reasonable orders of tuna salads, I wanted them full, happy, and with their loins girded for a hot afternoon, an evening of terrifying 1 in 3 humans that came in contact with them. I returned with an entire load of bread, sliced and buttered, and a second loaf wrapped in foil and placed in a brown bag to keep it warm. Their effusive praise and thanks lifted my mood, as only a kindness granted can bring, and I watched them leave a few moments later for my perch at the grill. My honor was defended, their stomachs were filled, and for the moment I nearly forgot about the pearly skin and staring eyes of the dead girl. Almost. Chapter 6. Birthday Suit. Sometimes, when I need to burn off tension, I walk. I don't run unless I'm being chased, but walking is quite acceptable, especially among the bucolic mountain scenery of my home. It's tough to keep a bad mood thriving after a few dozen lungfuls of Adirondack air. I know. I've tried. After feeding Gus and changing into ratty clothes that were more forest-ready, I wandered up the back path between my house and a row of birch trees that were busy shredding bark like a dog's hair on a white couch. Their small leaves rattled happily in the light wind, ignoring my bad mood altogether. I cast a look of mild reproof at the irritatingly pretty row and stalked off onto a well-worn path hemmed by low ferns and the odd blackberry. Up a mild incline, I found a deer path that doubled as a cut-through to the other side of town, a sort of impromptu sidewalk that locals used. The meandering track wove in and out of the trees, always at the edge of the meadow that circles the upper crescent of the lake, where there aren't many cabins or homes. One of the reasons halfway is still tranquil is that we haven't allowed it to be overrun with cheap vacation homes or hideous McMansions filled with visitors who don't care about the lake. Or the town. Or us, for that matter. You can always tell that type in the diner. They rarely remove their sunglasses when ordering the waitresses around. I'm glad we've dodged that particular tourist bullet. So far. I reached that point in a walk where the mind begins to travel in a sort of cheerful meander. I missed Wolfric, but knowing he was out there somewhere felt good. I knew he would come back, and we would celebrate by beginning the joys of discovery all over again. He was a sweet and careful lover. Not that I've taken a ton of men to bed, but I could feel a gentle strength within him that told me at every second we were together, he was aware of me. My needs, my size, which is more important than you might think. You try sharing a bed with a guy whose feet hang off the end of the mattress. He would take my face in his gentle hands and kiss me, all the while letting his body ease onto me with the grace of a deer. There was something primal about him that made me relax. Wolfric was above all else a man, not a boy. I reveled in his warmth when the sun was just coming up in that cool hour before the world woke up and life began. I picked a lovely fiddlehead fern and marveled at the mystery of its knurled green shape. After a few minutes, I was shadowed by some pines that ran along a slope when I noticed something. Actually, it was a lack of something, as in silence. Silence in the woods is rarely good. Birds should be calling, frogs doing whatever you call their noises, but, you know, slimier, and the bustle should never fade to stillness while you're standing in the middle of a fairly remote open space,
no matter how close it might be to town. I didn't even have to reach out my senses. I knew I was being watched. I lifted the fern head to my lips and nibbled at the crisp little jewel while casually reaching out with my magic to scan the area. There were two of them, that much I knew. What they were was opaque, and I dared not push too hard with my power, knowing that my charms would give away any concerted effort on my part. Blessed metal might store magic like a battery, but it vibrates like a tuning fork when you draw upon it. Any magical being in the area would feel it and know their cover was blown, and that might scare them. Frightened beings make bad decisions, and I didn't want to be on the receiving end of that kind of mistake. I let my power ebb, and then reached out again, but this time I did so slowly. Odd. Now there was one of whoever was watching. I kept my brows from raising and let my pace drop until I was taking steps slowly enough that each footfall was spaced by a quiet second. In those breaks, I listened. What I heard made my skin flush hot with anger. It was a feminine laugh, low and disdainful. The smell of tobacco smoke tickled my nose, and a series of most uncharitable thoughts bounced through my head, just as Anna spoke to me from ahead on the path. "Hi, Carly. You really are an outdoor kind of girl, aren't you?" She was perched on a rock, smoking, and blowing plumes in my direction. I think it was intentional, a sort of announcement that she was around, so that I didn't get startled and roast the little bitch with a spell strike. Even though I wasn't surprised, I weighed the possibility of faking it and frying her with a bolt out of sheer principle. Tragically, my better angels won out. I dropped my hand, albeit reluctantly. This version of Anna was quite different from the playfully sexy girl who'd frequented the diner before she left with Amelia, the daughter she shared with Wolfric. There was a tightness to her eyes, and a hardened expression that robbed her of whatever cute might have lingered. She was still exotic, but more like a venomous fish lying in wait on the bottom of the ocean. There was beauty, but there was palpable danger there, too. I watched her carefully and stood completely still, deciding to let her speak first. She did. "You only have him because it isn't convenient for me to..." She paused, letting her eyes slide over me, and I felt my face flush an even deeper shade of red at her barb. "Reclaim him," she finished, then granted me a frosty smile. "My pack will have these lands, Carly, with or without his blessing. We need the room, and he doesn't." "How do you know what he needs?" I snapped. I felt my mouth go dry at the question, as part of me hoped she didn't have an answer. She nearly purred with laughter. "He needs what I tell him he needs. He's really quite the man-child, that one. One minute he's making love to me and telling me that we'll never be apart, and the next he's worked himself into a frenzy over some meaningless prey animal with a broken leg. He's so perfectly unformed, despite his age. That's where I come in, Carly. Do you see?" She flicked her cigarette away and looked mournfully into the empty pack, then tossed it as well, ad littering to reasons for hating her. Not that I need it any more. "I think I do," I said. "You do," Anna's eyes narrowed. I'd given her the one answer she wasn't expecting. I walked a step closer toward her and had the satisfaction of seeing the hint of a flinch. So, she wasn't immune to threats. Good to know. "You lay underneath him like a $2 whore so that you could have a child, who you don't deserve, by the way, in hopes that you could lure him away from lands that your pack of half-breeds wants to control." She bristled, and I threw my next dart. "The problem is that your pack is too weak to keep any real powers out of your turf, so you're relegated to second-class lands in the middle of an empty wilderness. You don't even have the guts to stand and fight for it." I drifted my eyes up and down her petite form, then let them rest on her face. "Or maybe you do all of your best work on your back. I don't know, and I don't care. He's mine, and the lands are his. If you were serious about taking them, your alpha wouldn't have fled when I approached and left you to do the dirty work." Anna was getting angry now. I saw amber flashes in her eyes and knew she was struggling to contain the cat within. Good. I had more where that came from. I sniffed to let her know what I thought of her unseen master. That's beta behavior, Anna. Are you sure you've hitched yourself to the brightest star? She bared her teeth in the outline of a smile, sliding from her rock in a liquid grace as her feet hit the grass without a sound. Cocking her head, she regarded me with a cool gaze. I felt the animal inside her and didn't care for it at all. When she spoke, her voice bubbled with arrogance. My pack is perfectly capable of taking what we wish, especially from a half-coven of witches who would rather heal a bird's wing than practice actual magic. You've got bigger problems, Carly. You just don't see it yet. Or maybe you do, but the whole heart of gold thing has you blinded. She shrugged. Either way, you'll be gone soon. Her tone was frigid with certainty. In a shimmer, she dropped to all fours, and a midnight black panther stood staring at me with implacable golden eyes. It was gone in 3 bounding leaps, and I heard the birds start chirping again, although I wasn't sure I agreed with their sunny dispositions. I gritted my teeth and walked on, determined not to let Anna ruin my day. I saw signs of a fae in the area, but it seemed relatively innocent. The little forest dweller had carved glyphs onto a long, thick limb of an ash tree, and at a glance it turned out to be nothing more than a body joke directed at a rival family of Flutterbys. They're a medium fae with 4 wings, mouths like sailors, and a passion for keeping paths clear for travelers. I'd even classify them as helpful, if you get past their use of language. They've sung songs to me that would make a diesel mechanic drop everything and go to church. Naturally, I love them. I walked off my irksome experience with Anna the Wandering Skank and concluded by sticking my feet in the lake at the end of a low dock just across from the library. I knew Brendan was probably at work, but I wasn't quite ready for his kind of intense curiosity, so I did what I always do when I have a problem. I sat, completely still. Not thinking, really, and just letting the air and world move around me until words popped into my head without any invitation at all. He will, or he won't. That was the heart of it. I knew Anna was taunting me from a position of weakness. Wolfric and I were too far gone to be casual, and she knew it. Simply by showing her face, she'd tipped her hand. She feared me. That, I decided, was good. I let the sun warm my cheeks until the day began to fade, then got up to go feed Gus and spend some time writing a spell in my grimoire. I take refuge in the planning and execution of something as simple as writing, and the comforting bulk and accompanying rumbling purr of Gus would center me until the moon could rise, when all would be well once again. Chapter 7. Which Weird One? I was shoving somewhere near a pound of funnel cake into my mouth and trying not to choke on the fine, powdered sugar that tumbled from each glistening loop of dough like an avalanche. Mm-hmm. That was the best I could do for an answer. And Gran paused to look me over, one hand waving delicately at my general state of disarray. Child, are you aware that other people can see you eat? You haven't gone daft and forgotten you aren't invisible. Gran looked at me with a mixture of horror and amusement. What? I asked, as a minor avalanche of powdered sugar broke apart on my shirt. I really liked funnel cakes. She rolled her eyes and brushed me into a more respectable state, subjecting me to one of those moments where I felt like I was 5 years old again. I can't say the feeling wasn't welcome. I asked if you'd seen any of those clowns again. You know, the ones you insist on mentioning each time we speak, despite your most vigorous assurances that they don't frighten you. I coughed lightly to clear a particularly dusty remnant of funnel cake and shook my head. Not yet, and I'm not scared of them. It's just unusual to see clowns in full makeup eating salad niçoise with such delicacy.
They didn't order waffles. Gran raised a brow.
No. How scary can they be if they're making dietary mistakes like that? I asked, and we ambled toward the frozen lemonade. I was parched after my manhole cover-sized dollop of fried dough. I looked around at the general hubbub. The carnival, or circus, or whatever, was hopping. There were hundreds of teens, some of them couples holding on to each other with the desperation of an impending curfew. There were sunburned tourists, bad boys in cut-off shirts, and married couples walking around with that bemused patience that only 2 decades of marriage can bring. I saw a few friends from high school, about half the staff of the diner, and most of the city government, all involved in eating one form of meat on a stick, or in a tube, or something sweet. It was a good atmosphere. Gran leaned in and brushed more sugar from my cheek, a beatific smile on her face. "Do you feel it?" she asked, her lips not moving. I reached out after adopting the same bland smile. At the periphery of my senses, there was someone watching. No, I changed that conclusion when the presence skittered to one side in my mind. It was some thing. "It's moving. It's not fully alive or human." Gran nodded once, still smiling. The corners of her mouth twitched with pride. As usual, every moment was a chance to assume the role of a teacher. "I can't decide if it's just masking or truly dead. There's something almost playful about it." Her last phrase was tinged with admiration. If one could admire a creature who was most likely interested in eating you, or drinking you, or maybe both. We moseyed along the main area where the barkers were hawking their games, letting the crowd push us along like so many fish in a school. Gran's arm was looped through mine, and when the presence would pulse in my senses, she would feel it as well, and respond with a small twitch. She was always the slightest bit quicker to recognize the threat, a benefit of her decades of magical mastery. I knew we were being followed. I also knew that to assault us would be virtual suicide. I'm no pushover, but Gran was clearly on high alert, and doubtless had a spell of unsurpassed power resting lightly on her tongue. After a few moments of cautious advance, we came to the tent housing the actual entertainment portion of the sprawling melange of carnival and circus. There was no sawdust or sand scattered about. Instead, we walked onto a temporary floor of stained plywood scuffed to a sheen by untold feet. There were bleachers nearly filled with patrons, all chattering away to produce a deafening wave of sound kept under the tent by simple geometry. A listless employee was stamping the hands of patrons who entered the tent, but Gran waved the woman off with an apologetic smile. "We won't need to re-enter. Thank you anyway." Her tone invited no discussion, and the woman, a bedraggled 20-something with short blue hair, sensed that we weren't going to budge. With a sullen glare, she turned and began stamping more obedient customers in a rapid fashion. I caught a glimpse of the logo on a man's hand as he pulled it back after receiving a thumping blow from the angry stamper-in-chief. It appeared to be the number 8, hardly exotic enough to warrant inflicting harm. But then again, this was a circus, and I suspected they had slightly different rules of engagement. "Shall we?" I asked, and Gran smiled pleasantly at a family of 6 who slid obediently down their row to allow us space on the end of one bleacher. There were lights strung from each tent support, and all were turned down low to give the entire space a modest gloom that was shattered by occasional camera flashes from phones. We settled into our seats as the instinctive silence fell over the crowd, just before a loud pop was followed by a single blaze of white light that shot downward into the middle of the ring. "Showtime," said many of the people around us, and it was. The ringmaster was tall, thin, and dressed in the manner of a Victorian gentleman. His neatly waxed mustache shone brilliantly under the punishing spotlight, and his hair parted crisply to one side. He wore a red velvet jacket, cut high to reveal a snow-white vest, a watch and fob, and his trousers, they were too baggy to be pants, tapered to a narrow point just over his shoes that gleamed midnight black.
Gold suspenders peeped from either side as he turned to regard the crowd with an imperious smirk. He raised a long hand into the air and dropped it with practiced drama as he threw his head back and shouted, "Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome you to the very source of all things that are thrilling." Another spotlight snapped on to reveal a snarling tiger, causing a wave of "ahs" in the crowd. The ringmaster smiled indulgently, as if only he knew the secret of what wonders were truly coming. "Please, please, good people, we are only beginning. There are so many mysteries to be revealed this evening." His oily grin deepened as he shared a companionable moment with every member of the crowd. I had to admit, this guy was good. "Tonight you will see that which cannot be explained." Again the practiced pause, and another light flared into life. "By reason or science?" In the new column of light stood a woman perched on a sword, her heel balanced to perfection as she swayed delicately, while smiling through bone-white makeup slashed with red lips. Her body was encased in a singlet of glittering rhinestones, and she never moved, save to wave lazily at a group of children close enough to see her toes curl slightly, just before she leapt into the air and landed in a deep bow. With one finger, she caught the sword before it fell to the floor, then blew a kiss to the audience as the light went out, and the crowd erupted into wild cheers. "Okay, that was pretty good," I allowed, and Gran nodded along with me as we both joined in the raucous applause. The ringmaster raised a hand, quelling the crowd. He had them now. "Surely there are things more challenging to the mind." Although rhetorical, he allowed a generous pause for the vocal members of the crowd to feel included as their shouts rang out across the swelter of the bleachers. It was hot and getting hotter, and I felt my clothes sticking to my back in an unwelcome caress. The ringmaster began to speak, thought better of it, and closed his mouth with a theatrical click of his gleaming teeth. "No, I cannot." He waved vaguely, intimately. The motion included the expanse of the crowd, and he shrugged helplessly as people began to clamor for him to continue. After due time, he looked over one shoulder and then spoke. "Perhaps something from the netherworld?" His voice rang out in triumph, as a blue light blazed forth to illuminate a man clad in black, his head bowed to the floor. Both hands protruded from the folds of his robe like two pale fish. His fingers were long and white. With a snap, his head came up, and he bared his fangs at the audience, hissing with the rasp of a malevolent serpent. The crowd went nuts. At the expected outburst, the ghoulish apparition spread his arms wide and spoke in a high, tittering whisper that carried through the entirety of the tent. It was an eerie voice, full of stagecraft and projected by unseen speakers planted in the crowd and under the bleachers. "I bring you news of magic. I bring you news of laughter, even, and joy. But never forget, good friends, that one cannot simply trust that which is seen." His pitch rose to a squeal as more light spilled down from the darkened recesses of the tent. "Ah, they're here," I said. The clowns who loved olives made their appearance at last, six in total. Each was dressed in wild regalia, cobbled together with medieval elements and the odd hint of Golden Age Hollywood. The shoes were high, the heels flashing with chemical lights, and each clown carried a large metal hoop which they twirled expertly in dizzying circular patterns. "No wonder they visit the diner. They certainly are active lads, aren't they?" Gran remarked as the clowns began to weave about the sinister robed figure in a complex, enthusiastic series of gymnastic dance moves. They were fluid, odd, and beautiful, like watching squid flume through the water, free of limitations due to mundane things like gravity. I couldn't take my eyes from them, almost forgetting the man in the center who remained standing. No, he was lurking in the center column of blue light. The ringmaster faded from sight, but his voice would occasionally break into the whoops of the crowd as he commented on the continuing display of athletic calamity. All the while, the robed man rarely